I was 7 years old in 1976. It didn't rain all summer and the gardens turned brown, and I remember queuing with buckets down the end of Queen Street with Brendan and Mam for water from the standpipes. The drought got that bad. My day mare started that summer. I heard voices in my head. Not mad or drooly or especially scary even, at least not at first. The radio people, I called them, because at first I thought there was a radio on in the next room. Only there never was a radio on in the next room. They were clearest at night. But I heard them at school too, if everything was quiet enough, in a test or something, say. Three or four voices had chunted away at once, and I never quite made out what they were saying. Brendan had talked about mental hospitals and men in white coats, so I didn't dare tell anyone. Mam was pregnant with Jacko, Dad rushed off his feet at the pub, Sharon was only three, and Brendan was a plonker, even then. I knew hearing voices wasn't normal, but they weren't actually harming me, so maybe it was just one of those secrets people live with. One night, I had a nightmare about killer bees loose in the Captain Marlowe, and I woke up in a sweat. A lady was sat at the end of my bed saying, "Don't worry, Holly, it's all right." And I said, "Thanks, Mum, because who else could it be?" Then I heard Mum laughing in the kitchen down the corridor. This was before my bedroom was up in the attic. That was how I knew I'd only dreamt the lady on my bed, and I switched on the light to prove it. And sure enough, nobody was there. "Don't be afraid," said the lady, "but I'm as real as you are." I didn't scream or freak out. I mean, sure, I was shaking, but even in my fear, I felt it was like a puzzle or a test. There was nobody in my room, but someone was speaking to me. So, as calm as I could, I asked the lady if she was a ghost. "Not a ghost," said the lady who wasn't there, "but a visitor to your mind. That's why you can't see me." I asked what my visitor's name was. "Miss Constantine," she said. She said she'd sent the radio people away because they were a distraction and hoped I didn't mind. I said no. Miss Constantine said she had to go, but that she'd love to drop by soon because I was a singular young lady. Then she was gone. It took me ages to fall asleep, but by the time I did, I sort of felt I'd made a friend.
Oh, that is great. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And it turns out Miss Constantine is not exactly a friend.
No. She's a double or treble or quadruple kind of an agent. But yeah.
Now, David, how would you describe your main character, Holly Sykes? And this is the voice of the young Holly Sykes we've just heard. And how she figures into the narrative structure of this book?
Well, she's a complex kid. She's 15, pretty solidly working class. Her parents run a pub. She lives in a town called Gravesend, which is east of East London, where the Thames starts to turn into an estuary. It's traditionally quite a grungy, industrial kind of a town. And I hope she's likeable. She's tough. She's brighter than her vocabulary allows her to sound. And she's really the linking device between all of the six parts of my novel. She's the narrator in both the first and the last section, and also she's a major character in the lives of the narrators of the other sections. So we see her not only as a teenage runaway punkette daughter, but later as a lover, and later as the mother of the narrator's child, and later as a kind of a colleague and semi-platonic friend. And then in the fifth part of the novel, when sort of the laws of physics rather get exploded, she's a number of things. She's a sort of a sanctuary and a kind of marine in a metaphysical realm between life and death. But if I talk about that, then I'll take up all of our available time, I fear. Right. And then at the very end of the book, she's a grandmother, and she's an old woman in the 2040s in Ireland, in an era when our oil-addicted society is kind of going through quite a dramatic, violent, cold turkey for lack of oil.
Right. So your book spans decades, and these various sections are narrated by different characters with their own very distinctive voices, and you seem to be playing with different kinds of stories, even different genres. And I have to say, the whole thing is pretty dazzling.
Thank you.
You like playing with genres, don't you?
Yes. I mean, if I was pricklier than I am, then I might try to modify the verb play. Genre is what my novels need to deploy to be the novel that I want to write. I like writing things in smaller units. I'm almost more of a writer of novellas than I am a novelist, which isn't odd to say because I've never published a novella, but I have published novels that are made up of smaller parts, and in Old Money, these parts are novellas.
And they all interconnect then, and typically they're told through different characters with different voices.
Yeah, of course they have to add up to a novel, otherwise I'm in breach of the Trades Descriptions Act for selling them as a novel, but they are novella-esque enough to retain their own characters and their own flavours and textures and genre. So throughout the book we have kind of social realism in the 1980s and section I just read from, but we also have something steeped in the opposite end of the social spectrum, one of entitlement and money and privilege. We have war reporting, in a sense, in the third part, and a family wedding. We have satire and pastiche. Then we have the fantastic, and then at the end we have a kind of dystopian, steeped novella to close with.
So why do you like doing that, putting all of this together in the same book, these very different styles?
I guess because I'm an omnivore, and I like to write novels that pull the rug out from under the reader's expectations. I like that being done to me when I'm a reader, if it makes sense, if it's not just stupid or done as a gimmick. I like to be surprised by favourite writers. I'm just hungry to have contradictory, different hued, different coloured, different flavoured segments of my novels. And writing them in this way is how I can achieve that.
I mean, it's so interesting because I know there are a lot of well-known writers, literary writers, who have a horror of being labeled a genre writer. I mean, one way to look at this is at least parts of it seem to fit within the science fiction genre, maybe the fantasy novel. Does that bother you if you get labeled that way?
Not in the least. What bothers me is if my novel's no good. And so I work and think and work and think over 3 or 4 years to try to ensure that that doesn't happen, that somehow the novel does or is capable of being a vessel that holds these disparate elements together within the same book jacket and work and be an immersive world for the reader to enter and forget the level of reality that you and I are speaking on now and to enter the level of reality created by the book. That's what bothers me. That's my job. That's what I'm concerned with. I would like wall-to-wall universal praise and acclamation and glowing 5-star reviews from every quarter of the known media world, but hey, that's not going to happen, is it? And if the thought of that not happening was going to be a major problem for me, then I wouldn't write and I couldn't write. But I like writing too much to let that happen, so I write the best I can. I write the best books I can. I try to make each one better than the last. I try to make them engaging. I try to make them things that I would love to read if I weren't its author, and hope for the best.
Yeah. Now, as you've said, there are different kinds of styles that you're using here. I mean, there's one, the first section, it's kind of a sort of a story about teenage love and angst. There's another section about sort of student life in Cambridge University. And then there is also this more fantastical part, which kind of runs throughout the story, really a cosmic supernatural battle between the forces of good and evil. Why did you want to incorporate that into this story?
By looking at immortality, it licenses me to think about mortality. Now, I could have done that by setting the whole thing in a care home or write a classic midlife crisis novel about someone who notices he's getting older and as a response to that buys a sports car, obtains an inappropriate mistress and runs for office. But there were already books like that out there, and some are really good, but that just wasn't what was floating my boat. I wanted to look at this thorny topic about how to develop a saner relationship with aging than thinking of death as a grim reaper waiting for you in a care home. And I tried to do that by putting at the heart of the novel this Faustian pact and this question, really. If you could cheap death, if you could retain the youth and health and squanderable bank account of days and time that you have in your 20s, what would you be willing to pay for that? Would you be willing to amputate your conscience, for example, if that deal cost innocent people their souls or their lives? Would you be willing to fake your death every 10, 15 years and leave behind your family and everyone you love before people start to notice you're not getting any older? Now, this is a sort of fantastical way to look at issues about mortality, but it's what I wanted to do. As it happens, I hope it makes a page-turning narrative. I hope it's fresh and original. I hope it kind of ticks the literary boxes that I like to have ticked when I'm a reader. That's my answer, really.
And we should say that there's, within this particular part of the novel, there are these two groups of immortals, the anchorites and the horologists. Can you explain who these people are?
Sure. Well, you said good and evil earlier. I mean, of course, good and evil is basically dull. Mad Men is so good because there's no out-and-out villains and there's no out-and-out angels. So from the anchorites' point of view, well, I should explain who they are first, but the anchorites are members of a shadowy society who have obtained occult knowledge, and they are able to decant the right kind of soul in the right kind of mind and convert that into their own immortality, so they do not age.
They basically kill young children with certain proclivities so that they can live forever.
They're not necessarily children, it's just children tend to be easier to lure into the chapel in the dusk where this process happens. But yes, that's essentially it. Now, from their point of view, are they really that evil? From their point of view, they could say, come on, there's 7 billion people on this planet. There's more human. Earth does not lack human beings. All we do is take one, just about one a year. People go missing all the time. And maybe they wouldn't have had very good lives anyway. Maybe they were beggars or homeless, or maybe they would have contracted some terminal disease in the near future. And how about you? You know, how many sentient life forms have you eaten in the last year, unless you're a vegan, in order to prolong your existence? I mean, all we take is one. Are we much more guilty than you? So hopefully this is sort of a real offer that sounds a little bit tempting and maybe not that horrific after all. So from their point of view, they certainly wouldn't describe themselves as evil. Now, they are set against the horologists. The horologists are also immortals, but of a rather different nature. They're involuntary. They don't know why when they die. They wake up again 49 days later in the body of a very sick child whose host soul has gone because the body kind of momentarily entered death, but which is well enough for the horologist's soul to enter and then live that life and grow and exist as a human being until that human being dies. And then the same thing happens 49 days later. They wake again in a body of the opposite gender anywhere on Earth. And this happens again and again and again and again. They don't know why, they just do.
It's kind of like Bill Murray in Groundhog Day, except for this goes on for centuries.
Yes, and Bill Murray lives his lifetime, but wakes up again. And it's not that they're immune to time. It's not that they're caught in a trap of eternal recurrence, as Bill Murray is. They move through history, as we do. It's just death is not the end. After a few incarnations, they begin to wonder, well, what are we here for? What can we do? And they begin to suffer that sort of ennui that elderly vampires begin to suffer from, because they don't have mortality to define the meanings of their lives for them. So what they do is essentially decide to be doctors. They decide to be philanthropists and to find meaning in that. Partly they're doctors because if you're born as some insignificant serf in 11th century China, especially as a woman, your only hope of climbing the social ladder and having a halfway decent life is through medicine. But also, the horologists view themselves as medical force because they are aware that from time to time, cults that feed on human souls will happen. The anchorites aren't unique in human history. There are individuals who obtain this knowledge and kind of become soul vampires through history. And then there are larger groups that are more problematic. They see these groups as cancer cells in the body of humanity, and they see themselves as the therapists whose purpose it is to cure humanity of this cancer. Mm. So that's why they go to war.
So there's a really a profound philosophical question you're asking here, which is, you know, what would it be like if we were immortal? I mean, would life have any meaning? And I mean, really, the underlying question is death what gives life meaning?
It does. There's one more underlying question, which is intergenerational ethics. And this sort of comes to the fore in the final part of the book, as the world is going to pot because we haven't planned for our grandchildren's future and we've just lived as if it's okay if the planet dies after our deaths. We are running up a massive tab environmentally and in terms of our putting in infrastructure that will allow our civilization to sustain itself post-oil and to keep our grandchildren and children even in the manner to which we have become accustomed. We're running up a massive tab which our kids and our grandchildren will have to pay. If we were immortal, I think we would not do this with such reckless abandon. Even if we lived to be 100 or 150, we wouldn't.
So I want to come back to the more metaphysical side of death then. I mean, play this out for me. Why do you say that death is basically what gives us meaning?
Well, this is deep stuff, and we need a bar and five beers and about 2 hours to really do this properly. It's also really easy to sound hammy, but I suppose what I'd like to say is that a more fruitful relationship with death is not to think of it as this negation of life, this awful end that we are hurtling towards. I don't know about you, but I don't find that very helpful. I prefer to think of life as being this thing, this built-in clause that says, it's there at the beginning, it will end. And for this clause to be a kind of a companion that reminds us to live fully. I don't know. I don't know if you have kids, but...
I have two kids, yeah.
Fine. Then you will have noticed that often you are stressed out and things are not going as you would wish. And you can either lose it, lose your temper, shout, and the day will be miserable. Or exactly the same sequence of events can happen up to that point. But if you don't lose it, if you be patient and kind and compassionate and think, OK, we'll just get through this. This is a rough 5-10 minutes and I'll explain what's going on with love and patience, then you have a lovely day. And it's exactly the same things have happened, but your attitude has changed everything. Now, if mortality can be a little voice whispering in your ear, just keep a lid on things. This day won't be coming back. Your kids are getting older. You're getting older. Your supply of days is not infinite. They are numbered. All of them are numbered at whatever age you're at. So just enjoy it and relish it and don't mess it up by a harsh word. That, for me, seems to be a more commendable strategy. And perhaps our awareness that our days are finite can help us to do that a little bit more often and have a richer time while we are here.
So if you were offered the deal, the chance at immortality, and let's say without having to sell your soul, you don't have to do the Faustian bargain, but you could live forever, you would say no?
Well, we'd have to think about it, wouldn't we? And that's why it's not a Manichaean proposition in the book. It's sort of, I need it to be a tempting bargain for all of us, not just the psychopaths and sociopaths amongst us. Yeah, I'd say no. I'd be sorely tempted, but I think I would realise that I'm human because of the fact that cellular decay is built into what I am. And if you cheat that, if you take that away, then I'm not human in the same way. What do you think? What would you do?
I would say no as well. I mean, the whole idea.
Why?
It scares the hell out of me. The idea that you,
really?
I'd be here forever. Yeah, I don't know. Somehow that just does not seem terribly attractive to me. I don't know. Maybe that shows something about the depressive side of me. I'm not sure.
Oh, well, I would say it shows you're an enlightened man.
Do you think about death a lot?
Well, I think you have to be clinically insane to not think about it a little bit. No disrespect to the clinically insane. Maybe they think about it a lot. Maybe they think about it too much, but it's no good to deny it. It's no good to be an ostrich and think, no, 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 put your hands over your ears and say, la-di-da, I can't hear you. That will screw you up. And our society kind of encourages that with the way that we worship youth and beauty and dismiss the value of our seniors and old age. Maybe other cultures are rather better at this, but ours isn't very good at it. If you're an alien anthropologist studying Earth from our media, you'd think that we'd have some sort of, I don't know if you remember that old Logan's Run film where
yes.
when you hit about age 33, you were sort of incinerated in some aerial ecstasy 70s orgiastic dome. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
Then, so we need to work this out for ourselves. There's no one really out there to mentor you for old age. You get loads of help how to be a constructive young member of society, but not a lot of help.
I have to tell you
at the other end of life.
Yeah, I was at a dinner party once with I think there were 8 of us, and we started talking about death, and somehow the question came up. So, do you think about death every day? And it turned out 7 of the 8 people think about death every day in that particular dinner party. I was the only person who didn't.
And oh, really?
I sort of came away thinking, you know, maybe I'm kind of this shallow person who doesn't do that.
I mean, you never sort of think about, say, if you're waiting for a green light as a pedestrian and kind of the cars are hurtling by, you know, you never sort of...
Oh, I do. I do think about that. I'm just not sure that it happens.
Stepping out and being blammed by a car. You never think about that at all?
Oh, I do. I just not every day. Yeah. But no, I absolutely I think about that. Yeah. Or that, you know, you standing on a balcony and there is sort of this slight urge to hurl off.
Yeah, there is, isn't there?
Yeah.
It's not the heights that are scary. It's that urge that's scary, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
That's behind vertigo.
Yeah. There's one other thing that I wanted to ask you about in your novel. There's a lot of, I guess what I would call paranormal stuff that's happening here. There's sort of a whole cosmology that you develop. I mean, there are people with psychic abilities. They hear voices and channel other spirit beings. There are telepathic, even precognitive abilities. People can sort of predict the future. There's sort of a suggestion that there's some level of shared consciousness. And I'm wondering if, is this just all good literary fun, or do you take these ideas seriously at all?
It's mostly good literary fun, but the world's a mysterious place and the laws of physics are not written in concrete. They have cracks, and the next generation of scientists explore these cracks, and there's cracks in those theories as well, and the generation after explores those cracks and finds newer, deeper, more underlying laws of physics in the nature of matter and the nature of mind. So I wouldn't rule out anything that I've written either.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. Have you had any experiences like this? I mean, what we would classify as paranormal experiences, you know, uncanny coincidences, clairvoyant dreams, that kind of thing.
Nothing that I wouldn't put down to possible coincidence, except one visit from a ghost when I was living in Japan, aged about 26 or so. That was fairly... I can't really rationalize that away, but
can you tell us what happened?
It wouldn't sound very impressive. I was just woken up in the middle of the night by a very strong presence standing at the end of my bed that wanted to know what I was doing in that house. So I was wide awake and not as calm as I'm making this sound. But eventually, I explained what I was doing there and. The presence didn't go, but I felt that it had accepted my explanation and I was allowed to go back to sleep, so I did, and that was it. That was it. How about you? Have you ever had anything like that?
I have not, at least things that I can sort of explain away, but I have people close to me who have, so.
Yeah. There's a lot of it about, and yeah. Most of it sort of, I think, is explicable within a scientific or psychiatric paradigm, but even the sort of the edges of these paradigms are not clear cut and they get hazy, and this sort of meshes quite well with what the novel is. The novel is this sort of big baggy form where inexactitude and the inchoate can thrive and prosper and be turned into and used by narrative.
So the novel is, it kind of lends itself towards the mythic, is what you're saying.
It can do. It can lend itself towards pretty much any direction that the writer wants to take it. That's why it's, you know, it's sort of, for me, it's the ultimate blue tack art form. I think you call blue tack sticky tack here, is that right? It's kind of this big sticky stuff that you put postcards on the wall with.
Yeah.
In terms of form, I think the novel is a sticky tack art form, and it's forgiving and big and generous, and its potential is pretty much infinite. And that's one of the several reasons why I'm really happy and feel very privileged that I can spend my working life devoted to it.
Well, there's one thing I'm curious about. The Bone Clocks has gotten a huge amount of praise and acclaim, but there's also been a common refrain among certain critics who wish you just give up the magic and, you know, stick to the real world characters and plots. What do you make of that criticism?
It's not my job to think about it that much. I mean, I'm a novelist and I do the best job I can to write the best novels I can. I'm glad there are people out there who think about it, but I'm kind of not one of them. This book needed this fantastical element in. I didn't have any choice. It wouldn't have been the book I wanted to write had I exorcised it of the places where the laws of the natural world are bent or have holes blasted through them. And it's my job to bring the book into the world the way I want it to be. So that's kind of, it sounds like a clever evasion of the question, but it's not supposed to be. This is what the book needed to be, so this is how I wrote it. And I didn't feel I had the choice. So kind of why not? Almost who cares? I mean, surely what matters is the book any good or not? And why can't literary novels contain elements of the fantastical? What about The Master and Margarita, written by Mikhail Bulgakov, set in, I think, 1930s Stalinist Moscow, where we have a talking cat, where the devil comes to Moscow to hold and wants an essentially banquet, where Jesus Christ and Pontius Pilate meet and converse. It's a brilliant, brilliant novel. And does everything have to read like a late Henry James novel for it to be any good? Really? What about Midnight's Children? What about 100 Years of Solitude? I mean, maybe I nailed my true colours to the mast more visibly than I meant to then, but kind of come on is how I feel, you know.
Well, your book is such a pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome, and thank you for the interview, and it's been really good speaking with you, and thank you for putting up with my occasional rough around the edges voice.